Darwin's Wharf, Thursday, April 22. The river is heaving, all that ice now cracked and broken into jagged blocks, a million small icebergs ready to roll downstream. We have days at most before it is moving again. It is beautiful and terrifying, this opening of the river. And on more than one occasion, the ice has heaped its fury along the riverbanks, piling up and destroying everything in its path. It's why there are no homes directly beside the river. They are all built on the other side of Water Street, safely away from the threat of flood and wreckage. The wharves, however, are in danger, and Sam Darwin stands at the end of his, checking the beams for cracks and decay. "Will it be today?" I ask. And when he turns, startled, I point at the river. "Or tomorrow?" He shrugs.
"It will be a mess either way. I'll likely have a good bit of rebuilding to do."
Sam has built his wharf a bit farther into the river than most, better for fishing and for water traffic. But it's a gamble when the thaw comes. He could end up rebuilding the entire thing.
"Have you come to check on May again?" he asks.
"No. This time I came to speak with you."
"Oh? About what?"
I fold my hands together and rest them in front of me. "The rope."
"What rope?"
"The one you used to hang Joshua Burgess." I catch his gaze and do not let go. I watch his brow furrow in confusion, then his eyes widen in shock. "The same rope you threw to Jonathan that night so he could pull you out of the river. Where is it?" Sam shakes his head, but it's too quick, too frantic.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
I would have believed that without question last week, before I saw the lace. When Sam doesn't answer, I take a step forward and point. "In your pocket." He goes perfectly still, says nothing. It reminded me of what Rebecca Foster told me, how Joshua Burgess ripped a strip of lace from the hem of her shift before he raped her, that he tied his hair back with it. Sam jerks away with revulsion, his face contorting in horror.
"It isn't. You can't think that I..."
"No, I don't think you had anything to do with what happened to Rebecca. But I do believe that you killed Burgess. I just can't figure out why. It's to do with that lace, though. I am certain of it." I wait for Sam, having long since learned that a man who does not want to speak won't. But I can see it there. This urge in him, bubbling up, to explain himself. He curls his fingers into fists, releases them, grinds his teeth together, snorts in frustration. And still I wait as Sam Darwin wrestles with himself.
"It was May," he says finally. "Burgess caught her alone at the frolic last November. She'd gone out to the privy to relieve herself. Just a few minutes before he caused that scene with Hannah. I didn't notice. I was so caught up in the fight. I had no idea she'd slipped away. But she was out there when we pitched Burgess into the snow. And he was furious. Poor May, oh God. She had no idea what had happened. But he caught her coming back to the dance. Dragged her into the barn. He..." Sam clears his throat. Shakes his head. Baffled, he blinks back hot, furious tears. "It was so loud inside. You know how it is. No one heard her crying. But when she didn't come back, I went looking for her. And I found him, standing above her, lacing his trousers." The look on Sam Darwin's face is nothing less than tormented. "She was right there, weeping in the hay. Pushing down her skirt, I should have noticed she was gone. I should have gone out looking for her. I should have." Sam plunges his hand into his pocket and pulls out the slender piece of lace. "He took it from her, like some kind of damn trophy. Took the time to tie his hair back so it wouldn't get in the way while he raped her."
"So you beat him then?"
"No, he bolted. And I had to decide whether to help May or chase him. But once I got her inside the house, safe and settled, I went after him. He continues, fast and frantic now. I'd seen what happened to Mistress Foster when she came forward, how people whispered and took sides, how they blamed it on her even though she'd been at home minding her business when they came. The law did nothing. It still hasn't. North was acquitted, for God's sake. I wasn't as patient as Isaac Foster to see justice done, or as naive. I had no interest in letting it play out in a court of law.
So you killed him?
Wasn't hard. He shrugs, defiant. He'd gone through the woods on foot. We found him easy enough, what with the tracks he left behind. I'm not sorry, Mistress Ballard, and you'll never hear me claim to be.
I'll never ask that of you, Sam.
What are you going to tell the law?
I shake my head.
No. Then why do you care?
I think of Cyrus, of his bruised knuckles and split lip, of his weeks in the jail yard and the charges that have just been dropped. I need to know if my son had anything to do with that death. Because it matters.
If you ever speak a word of this, I'll call you a liar. And that's a word I never want to use against you, Mistress Ballard. Please don't make me.
I won't. I set a reassuring hand on his shoulder. I am curious about what you did with the rope, though.
I burned it.
Good. All the evidence is gone. He exhales then, as though it's settled.
An old farmer once told me that a wolf, once it's gotten a taste for human blood, must be killed because it will never stop hunting people from that point forward. I think it's the same with men, or at least some of them, and rape. I had a duty to kill Burgess. It would have been someone else's wife or daughter next. Yours, perhaps. Hannah, most likely. He'd already set his sights on her. What if she had gone out to use the privy instead? What would you have done, or Ephraim?
I know exactly what my husband would do, because I've seen him do it. Ephraim is the last man on earth who would ever think less of you, Sam. You don't have to fear him either. But go on, finish your story.
We caught him, Sam continues. Beat him and strung him from a tree.
But you kept the lace. Why? He swallows hard.
It's a reminder that May is mine to protect. I'll never fail her again. I won't.
Does that mean May's baby is...
possibly mine. I won't lie about that. We did go to bed last fall.
By the casual way he says it, I assume it was more of a regular habit than an isolated incident.
We were already betrothed, but when she turned up pregnant,
you married her early.
It was the right thing to do. I had to protect her. They would fine her in court, you know that. They'd call her a fornicator and the baby a bastard. And if anyone ever found out about Burgess, they would never look at May the same way again.
Or the child.
I don't care what they think of me, Mistress Ballard, but I'll not let them disparage her. She did nothing wrong.
I know that, and I don't blame you, Sam. I take a step closer to him. I have said it before, but I mean it. May is lucky to have you.
So you'll not tell?
Only my husband. We keep no secrets between us. We stand there watching the ice move in the river, and something else occurs to me. Sam.
Yes?
You said we. We caught him and beat him and strung him from a tree. That bit of doubt is back now, scratching at the back of my mind, and I have to know for sure. Did you take Cyrus with you that night? He shakes his head, laughs at the absurdity of such an idea.
No, I took Jonathan.
Pollard's Tavern, Friday, April 30. The Court of General Sessions meets on this last Friday of the month. It is the first warm day of spring. The sun is shining, the river is open, and what little snow remains in the hook is hard packed and dirty, heaped in the shadows and piled at the edge of the road. Mostly there is mud. Mud on boots and clothes and caked into horseshoes and spread across the floor of the tavern. Abigail Pollard has given up trying to keep the place clean,
and judging by the scowl on her face, is tempted to toss her broom into the hearth and let it burn. Instead, she chucks it into the corner and retreats to her table. When she sees me watching, she laughs, then lifts her mug and takes a long gulp of cider. I had not expected to find Joseph North on the bench. I had not expected to see him in public for some time, to be honest. But there he is at the table, wearing his robe and wig, sitting on a cushion, gavel in hand. If I'm being honest, he looks more than a little peaked. His skin is pale and there is a film of sweat across his upper lip. I have come here to do the thing required of me by my profession, and I had thought I'd be giving my testimony to Obadiah Wood. It was my understanding that he would be traveling down from Vassalboro until Judge North recovered from the strange illness that has kept him abed these last 10 days. Much has been made of this in the Hook. Rumors flitting this way and that, as happens in small towns such as ours. I've heard several versions myself. Consumption is generally agreed upon. The croup has also been mentioned, though no one has seen him cough. Indigestion, humors, the ague, all of these options have taken their turn around the rumor mill. Dropsy, gout, piles, the putrid sore throat, scurvy, diarrhea. It is boils, however, that most assume to be the cause of his affliction. Why else would he have spent 10 straight days laid up in bed and now be forced to use a cushion whenever he sits? It is the logical conclusion, and one I would have taken to myself under other circumstances. I can only assume that Dr. Page was paid handsomely for his silence, because dismemberment has not once been mentioned by anyone in the Hook. I know that North sees me at the back of the room, waiting to give my testimony. I know that he sees Ephraim as well. But I get the sense that North will not make a show of me today, or perhaps ever again. Today's court business is typical. Petty local issues, things of no major import to life or law. Just a great deal of ruffled feathers after a long, grueling winter. And I doubt there would have been but a handful of cases called if today had not been the day they buried Joshua Burgess. It's the first day the ground has been soft enough to dig a grave big enough, and Amos insisted it was time to get Burgess out of his shed. In the end, the same 7 men who cut Burgess from the ice committed him to the ground. It seemed fitting. And seeing as how there was no church, he couldn't be buried in the churchyard. Not that anyone would have wanted him to be. They chose the woods instead. Just a hole. No words were said. But Amos Pollard did insist upon a stone cairn.
Last thing we need is a leg bone getting dragged down the middle of Water Street if the dogs get to him,
Amos had said. No one argued. The whole fiasco drew a crowd, however. And of course, the crowd then wandered back to Pollard's. Then proceeded to get drunk. Now everyone has a complaint, and I am ready to be home.
Martha Ballard,
Joseph North calls my name from the front of the room.
You have business to attend.
I stand, make my way forward. I have evidence to give in a legal cause.
What manner?
He asks. This is the call and response that we have performed for many years now, as familiar to those in this room as a nursery rhyme. Few pay attention to us. An unwed woman has named the father of her child, and I bring it before the court so it may be recorded.
Name the woman, he says. Name the father.
I have done this countless times, of course, but it feels different now. And though I hate to do it, I will not shirk my responsibilities. On Sunday, April 18th, Sally Pierce gave birth to a son.
I may as well have dropped a large stone into a small pond for all the ripples this announcement makes.
Everyone listens now. Even North is surprised.
The daughter of William Pierce, he asks.
Yes.
I did not realize she was with child.
You are not alone in that, I tell him.
And who is the father of this child?
It is a long breath, and I draw it slowly. But I have only opened my mouth to answer when I feel a presence at my side.
I am, Jonathan says.
Quickly, softly, he reaches for my hand and gives it a squeeze.
And I have come to pay her court fee, 20 shillings, far and above anything required by law for a first offense. You will also find that I have posted our intent to marry outside the tavern.
Jonathan pulls a coin purse from his pocket and drops it on the table before Henry Sewell. He watches as the confession and the fee are recorded, then signs his name beside both.
Do you have any other business to attend, Mistress Ballard?
North asks. I know that he is in pain, but I think being robbed of the chance to humiliate me before the court hurts him most. No, I say, but then I cannot help myself. And I add, though I would be remiss if I did not inquire about your health. I've been told it's taken a turn for the worse of late. He clenches his jaw, glares at me.
Do not concern yourself with my welfare. I am on the mend. A credit, no doubt, to being tended by a trained medical professional.
I care not what his reaction might be, and I have turned. I'm halfway through the room when Jonathan catches up with me. North bangs his gavel, adjourning court, and the crowd rises, pushing back their benches, muttering, gossiping.
I am not such a bad man as you might think,
Jonathan says, his mouth near my ear. I have never thought you a bad man.
Even now?
You did the right thing by Sally, and by your son.
That's not what I mean. Sam said that you came to see him, that he told you of my part in that business.
I stop as the room swirls around us. Set my hand on his cheek. I feel the stubble beneath my hands. He has Ephraim's eyes, a steely kind of blue. They are kind but filled with a deep resolve.
Ask your father about a man named Billy Crane, I tell him, and you will understand why I am not angry with you.
Friday, April 30. Clear and warm. Joshua Burgess buried this morning. Have been to the Hook for court. Came home in the afternoon. Barnabas Lambert tarries for dinner. Moses Pollard as well. Jonathan brought Sally along with their new son. I have been at home. 12 years ago. Hollowell, Maine. April 30, 1778. Ephraim pulled the 3 large stones from the wagon one at a time and set them on the ground. It had been raining when we arrived the day before, a soft, warm spring rain, but still inconvenient given we were sleeping in tents. But now the sun was out and the children were spread across the clearing, exploring this new place. They ranged in age from Cyrus, almost 22, to young Ephraim, not quite a month. I have been at this a long time, I told my husband as we stood beside the wagon. I held our baby in the crook of my arm. I am done with babies, moving, upheaval.
I am happy to be done, he said, and kissed my forehead. Now that I have finally gotten one named after me.
It took him 9 years to convince me to make this move. A patient man is Ephraim Ballard. Our home was in Oxford. Our daughters were there. That was the hardest thing for me to reconcile. Leaving them. I could agree that Ephraim was right about the rest. We needed land and lots of it. And it made perfect sense to put his carpentry skills to use in the lumber trade. But the starting over? The living in tents while he built us another house from the ground up? I wanted no part of that. Young Ephraim was a surprise. Born 7 years after Dolly, he had arrived long after I thought my childbearing efforts complete. It was my pregnancy with him that forced me to relent. We had run out of room and opportunities in Oxford. Our compromise was to bring our daughters with us in spirit.
Come, Ephraim said.
Let's find the right spot for our girls. He took the baby from my arms then, and we began a slow stroll across the property. He showed me where he wanted to build the house.
Big enough that you can have your own workroom, he said. Hannah and Dolly can have their own bedroom, as can the boys, but upstairs.
That's a big house.
Yes, that's exactly what I've been trying to tell you. It will be big enough to hold us all, and all the children that our children will have one day as well. Big enough for a loud, raucous Christmas.
We wandered on.
That's where I'll put the barn. And there,
he pointed to the swollen, gurgling creek,
is where I'll build the mill. Bigger than the barn. Big enough to store entire loads of lumber. And once I've got it finished, I'm going to make a pier that stretches out over the water so we can shove the logs directly into the current. Maybe I'll even have a water wheel one day as well.
He had already named it Mill Creek, and farther on, it spilled into the Kennebec, a fierce and raging river. It was broad and deep and moved fast with spring rain and snowmelt. But that, he assured me, was exactly what you want in the lumber trade. You must transport the boards, you see, and you needed a river to do it. Ephraim showed me pastures and gardens, and paddocks that didn't yet exist. A hen house, a kitchen garden, an orchard. The woodlands were there already, of course, as was the pond. But I saw the rest clearly enough as he painted each detail with words. It took an hour, this wandering across the land, and I found that by the end we were both headed in the same direction, toward a huge ancient live oak that grew at the top of the hill in what Ephraim was already calling the South Pasture. Its canopy spread 50 feet at least, and its roots were old and gnarled, its leaves a fresh and burgeoning green that would provide plentiful shade in summer. He pointed to the base of the tree.
That's a foxhole, and that, love, means that we'll be watched over in this place.
I nodded but couldn't speak.
You are tired.
Ephraim wiped a tear off my cheek with his knuckle.
Sit down and rest.
He handed the baby to me and strode back to the wagon. One by one, he brought the stones and placed them beneath the tree. And when it was done, he settled onto the damp grass beside me. He reached out and brushed a thumb along my cheek.
I would not wish any companion in the world but you, he said.
You're just full of the bard today, aren't you? I asked. And when he laughed, I quoted a line myself. For which of my bad parts didst thou first fall in love with me?
For all of your parts, those inward and out, he answered,
pulling me closer so that he could press a kiss onto my forehead.
Together we turned to survey this place, where we would build a new life together.
It feels good to be home, I said, and it did. Our revels now are ended. There is screaming in the distance, somewhere out there, beyond the garden gate. It wakes the woman from a deep and restful sleep, and she is left kicking against the covers, reaching for the tail end of a dream that makes no sense. Something about ropes and rivers. But it fades from her mind as she sets bare feet on the scuffed wood floors. The screaming grows louder now, more intense, and two long strides bring her to the window where she pushes aside the heavy curtains. For the first time in many long months, there is no frost on the corners of each glass pane, no bits of silver filigree that catch the light. Spring has finally come to the town of Hollowell. No, she thinks, listening closer. Not screaming. The sound is that of whining and whimpering, but not a dog, nor a wolf, not the mean yip and snarl of a coyote. It is gentler, softer. So it is my fox, then, she thinks. The woman grabs a blanket from the foot of the bed and wraps it around her shoulders. The floorboards creak with age as she moves toward the front door. Her feet are bare, pale and ghostly. but it is warmer now, and she has no need of stockings, of boots. When the woman pulls the door open, she sees the fox immediately.
"Tempest," she says,
her voice little more than a breath in the cool morning breeze. The river is open. Where once the ice lay thick and solid from bank to bank, now it moves in a molten, gurgling flow. It is still cold as death from the long winter and the snowmelt, but has become a churning, lethal wall of water, dirty and dark, flowing south. And there in the distance, if you listen closely, is the sound of a water wheel. It too turns freely, sending its music into the dawn. A tinkling metallic charm. The fox hears both river and wheel as she sits at the entrance to her den, watching the woman. She hears them and is pleased. This is a gentle season, at least until the rains begin. That always brings a different kind of trouble. For now, however, the valley is lush and verdant and filled with new life. Nuts and berries and little creatures flitting from tree to tree. There are flowers, daffodils and iris and hyacinth. The soil smells fresh and ripe, tender shoots pushing through the surface of every field, worms and ladybugs and butterflies. The fox also has something to offer the world this spring, and she whimpers again, urging her kits to leave the den. They are hesitant, so her mate meets her at the entrance, presses his nose to hers. He shoves them out gently, one by one. Slowly they tumble into the grass and begin to explore the gnarled roots of the ancient live oak tree. They investigate this new place, scratch at the bark, sniff the three large moss-covered stones. They climb and tumble, hide and play. And all the while, the woman watches from her place at the door, watches and wonders. Remembering, wistful. Beneath her awe is a kind of grief, old and tender, like a scar. But even that cannot swallow the joy she feels at the sight before her. There are four kits, one male, big and red like his father, and three females, slender and dark like their mother, silver, rare.
Author's note. This is Ariel Lawhorn. If I could, I would string a line of caution tape right here across your path. Warning, danger, crime scene, do not cross. All the usual descriptors apply in this situation. If you are familiar with my books, you will already know that I am about to unpack this novel in detail. There will be revelations and explanations and spoilers aplenty. If this is the first fictional journey you have taken with me, may I say two things. Thank you for trusting me with your time, and turn back now. Do not listen to the following until you have first listened to the novel, beginning to end. Every story moves like a river, from source to mouth, so let this one flow. No doubt you'll have questions. I collect people. I come by this honestly, in the same way that others collect rocks or stamps or coins. My own father collected people. To be precise, he brought home hitchhikers. In his case, it was not a dangerous pastime. My father was once a rancher. As a teenager, a friend dared him to enter a bronc riding contest at the rodeo, but, dissatisfied with the 8 seconds that would win him the prize, he rode that bronco for 20 minutes straight, until it gave up altogether and stood still in the middle of the stadium, sides heaving, breathing a cloud of dust and manure. Needless to say, my father didn't technically win, but he proved his point. From there, he went on to serve as a military police officer in the army. He could handle hitchhikers easily enough. I mention that to say, like my father, I, too, am compelled to bring people home. Only I don't pick mine up on the side of the road. I find them in libraries and newspapers and strange corners of the internet. You see, the people I invite back to my place, my office specifically, and into my mind, are long since dead. A missing judge in 1930s New York, the only woman to ever serve aboard a Zeppelin aircraft, a Russian Grand Duchess, the most decorated woman to serve in World War II, and now a renowned but nearly forgotten midwife. I collect people. This one stumbled across my path in a doctor's office 15 years ago. I was pregnant with our youngest son, and my obstetrician was late for my appointment. He'd gotten tied up with a tricky delivery, and I'd gotten stranded in his waiting room as a result. I remember thinking that I should reschedule and go home. Had I done that, you would not be listening to this book. I was bored and had long since finished reading the copy of Stardust by Neil Gaiman that I'd brought with me. I'd thumbed through every magazine, and all that was left to read was a small devotional titled Our Daily Bread. For the record, I am not opposed to devotionals. This one had simply been hiding beneath a stack of alarming pamphlets, and I had not seen it until then. The entry for August 1st, 2008 read, The Midwife's Tale, and proceeded to tell the story of a woman named Martha Ballard who had delivered over 1,000 babies in her career and never once lost a mother in childbirth. My own doctor, the one I was anxiously waiting to see, couldn't boast a record like that. As happens every time I am struck by inspiration, all the little hairs stood up on the back of my neck. I tore that page out of the devotional and stuffed it in my purse. I have it here, on my desk, as I read this, and am laughing at the note I scribbled at the top that day. Would make a great novel. I kid you not, my doctor walked in 2 minutes later, and thus began a years-long process of research and writing and false starts. Elation and frustration and all of the things that bring a book into the world. But I never gave up. Which brings us to a very important conversation we must have regarding Martha Ballard and this specific novel. My longtime readers know how closely I stick to historical fact. It is a point of pride for me and why many have called what I write biographical fiction. The Frozen River marks my first real deviation from that track record. The book you are listening to is inspired by real events as opposed to being based on them. And as you are about to hear, I took great liberties not only with dates and details, but in some cases, the historical record itself. I did not do so lightly, and I have good reason for it. I would never present this novel as alternate history. Roughly 75% of what happens in this story closely follows the historical record. The rest is my version of what could have happened. But if you are looking for the facts, and nothing but the facts, ma'am, I highly suggest you pick up a copy of Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martha Ballard, A Midwife's Tale. It is, to the best of my knowledge, the only comprehensive history of her life, and is required reading if you want to understand Martha's role in history. It is an astonishing work of nonfiction. There are numerous instances where I changed, edited, clarified, or condensed Martha's diary entries. For example, the places where Martha records that Rebecca Foster has sworn a rape on a number of men, among whom is Judge North, includes diary entries from both August 19th and December 23rd. I did this to give a clearer, more immediate idea of what happened to Rebecca that horrible night. Not every diary entry that is included happens in the year or even on the specific date listed. A very small handful are fictional. My goal was to take many of the things that interested me about Martha's life and condense them into one story that takes place over a 6-month period. The court system in early America was nothing like it is today. At the time this story takes place, the Constitution had existed as the country's founding legal document for only 2.5 years, and the Bill of Rights had not yet been ratified. In Martha's day, there was only the Court of General Sessions, where you could sue your neighbor for petty reasons, the Court of Common Pleas, that considered more serious crimes such as assault, the Supreme Judicial Court, that handled rape, murder, and appeals from the lower courts, and the Supreme Court of the United States. There were only 6 justices, and its first meeting was on February 1st, 1790, toward the end of when this story takes place. So when I ask you to take everything you know about due process and legal matters and throw it out the window, that is why. Honestly, the citizens of early America were lucky to have a justice system at all. After waiting for many years, I seriously began this novel during the COVID-19 pandemic. What that meant for me, personally, is that I wrote surrounded at all times by 4 adolescent boys, and all the noise and chaos that entails. It is not my preferred method of writing by any stretch, but it was illuminating for one specific reason. I had to do my work right smack dab in the middle of my family life, and that is exactly how Martha Ballard lived and worked for decades. There was no separation. One phrase in her diaries repeated thousands of times over 27 years. I have been at home. When I first came across that oft-repeated remark, I thought little of it. But it took on new meaning for me during the pandemic because I, too, could write that in my own diary. I have been at home for months and months and months, for years, in fact. If you read Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, you will find a very different Martha Ballard than the one portrayed in this story. In fact, you may not recognize them as the same woman. I did that on purpose. I wrote Martha as she came to me, and, given that history has recorded so little of her, I will argue that my version is, at the very least, plausible. Should you endeavor to get a copy of her diary yourself, know this. It is very expensive. Picton Press published a limited number in 1992, and mine cost $350. It is very dry, and it's not really a diary at all. It's more a daybook. Martha does little to no editorializing. Only a handful of times in 27 years does she reveal her feelings about anything she records. Instead, she gives us the date, the weather, and the facts. The longest entry she made in that time was on December 23, 1789, the date of Rebecca Foster's first legal hearing in Vassalboro. And though Martha was literate, a thing unheard of for women in her time, few readers today would be able to decipher much of what she wrote. Here is an example of an entry I included in the book. You'll understand why I edited it as I did. 3. 5. X. Birth. Charles Clark's third dot. XX. Clear morn. I was called by Cowan to Charles Clark's wife in travail at 2H morn. She was safe delivered of a dot, her third child, all dots, at 4th hour. I left her cleverly at 8 and was conducted to Mr. Pollard's. This entry is listed under the year 1789. The 3 is the day of the month and the 5 is the day of the week. I changed it to November 26th in order to open Martha's story with the birth of Betsy Clark's daughter, or Dot. And the rest takes a good bit of patience to sift through. The real entry goes on for a bit longer but contained information that did not pertain to my story, so I did not include it. Throughout, she makes no effort at consistency when it comes to the spelling of names or places, so I did that for her in this story. What I'm saying is, you're welcome. A few more things, because I'm sure you're curious. A note on the various currencies mentioned throughout the novel. I use dollars and pounds interchangeably. Both were in use at this time, though the dollar, named after the Spanish dollar, was the primary coinage. However, English pounds were still in heavy circulation as well. Martha mentions receiving both forms of payment in her diary, despite the fact that the U.S. dollar was not established as the official currency until 1792 and was not minted until later that same year. It would seem that she was willing to take whatever payment she could get, or in many cases, chickens, coffee, sugar, or wool instead. Martha was paid in goods and services as frequently as with money. Sally Pierce really did have Jonathan Ballard's illegitimate son. But he was born in February 1791, almost a year after this story ends. And yes, Martha did have to take her testimony in childbirth. It's the closest she comes to being gobsmacked in her diary. However the young couple might have felt about each other, they went on to have 12 more children. 3 were stillborn. Cyrus Ballard never married or left home. But Martha gives no reason in her diary as to why. Ulrich notes that it was rare for a man to remain unmarried and in his parents' household in that day, and she postulates that he might have had some sort of mental or physical disability that prevented him from finding a wife. I connected those imaginary dots to a tragic time in Martha's history so that it would fit neatly within the story I wanted to tell. Moses Pollard and Hannah Ballard did indeed get married. The wedding happened in 1792, and shortly thereafter they moved to Fort Western and opened a tavern of their own. The happy couple went on to have 9 children between 1794 and 1809. Barnabas Lambert and Dolly Ballard met a bit later than I describe in this book. They married in 1795 and were the rather prolific parents of 11 children. Their first was born in 1796. As recorded in Martha's diary, Dolly, her sister, and their husbands visited often. Sam Dalwyn did indeed fall through the ice trying to get to shore on a raft with Jonathan. But here is where I made a major deviation in the story. He never saw a body. Which brings us to Joshua Burgess. Captain Joshua Burgess was one of 3 men accused of raping Rebecca Foster in August 1789. Yes, you heard that right. 3. The third, a man named Elijah Davis, was cut from this story altogether. I did that in part to simplify the narrative. The harder reason, however, is that in Martha's diary, those 3 men sexually assaulted Rebecca Foster 3 different times over the course of 1 week. What is portrayed as horrific here was in fact a series of 9 unspeakable assaults in real life. I could not bring myself to write that. Joshua Burgess disappears from the pages of Martha's diary somewhere around December 1789. Poof, he's gone. She never mentions him again. Could he have skipped town? Absolutely. Is it also possible that he died somehow or somewhere? Sure. So I went with that and used it as the bedrock for the novel. I mean, honestly, I don't feel sorry for the guy. He's dead to me. A word about rape. It is, unfortunately, nothing new. Sexual assault and all its gradients have been with mankind from the beginning. We find records of it in every ancient text from the Bible to Shakespeare. And yes, okay, my solution to a gross injustice is severe, or severing, if you will, and shocking, and not a little excessive. But I would like the record to show that when Larry McMurtry made a similar choice in Lonesome Dove, they gave him a Pulitzer. So, you know, poetic justice, man. The real Joseph North walked away scot-free from his trial and was never made to account for his crimes. That is unconscionable to me. I cannot change history, but I do have control over the stories I tell. And in this instance, at least, I gave him what he deserved. In writing that scene, I could not help but think of a friend who suffered unspeakable predations for much of her childhood and adolescence, until she finally took matters and a knife into her own hands and drove it into the thigh of her abuser. My friend, so young and brave and broken, looked at him, trembling, and said that if he ever touched her again, next time she wouldn't miss. He never did, and this ending was for her and for every other woman who hasn't seen justice in her lifetime. It's not enough, but it's something. It is worth noting here that the rape trial of Joseph North did not happen until July 1790. In an effort to better serve this story, I condensed the time frame. But other than that, every detail is accurate, including the fact that Rebecca Foster did not attend. Martha's diary does not record a reason why. Primarily, I made that choice so that the entire story could be contained within the opening and closing of the river. If you are familiar with Martha's life, either through the Ulrich biography or through her diary itself, you will know that she makes no mention of being a sexual assault survivor herself. Was she? According to statistics, which I do not think have changed much in the last few hundred years, there is a 33% chance of it being true. Of every decision I made in this book, that was the riskiest. The truth is, I don't know, but it would help explain the deep devotion she felt for Rebecca Foster. Regarding Tempest, she burst into my life in the middle of the night on June 19, 2018. My husband and I woke up to a sound that can only be described as our most dearly beloved being slaughtered in their sleep. Turns out, after a mad dash through the house at 3 a.m. to make sure our children were still alive, we discovered a fox barking in our yard. Look that up on YouTube and see if it doesn't give you the heebie-jeebies. A few hours later, a newborn baby entered my life. It's a long story and not mine to tell, but those two things became inextricably linked in my mind: the fox and the baby. To this day, I am fiercely protective of both. So it made sense that they should each have a part in this book. 1785 was known as the year of the long winter to the residents of Hallowell, Maine. Martha Ballard's diary records that the river froze on November 25th and was still solid on April 22nd of the following year. I changed it so that those events happened between November 1789 and April 1790. The year that Rebecca Foster swore a rape against a number of men. Martha's diary mentions the Negro female doctor who came to town. No first name is ever given for her, so I simply named her Doctor. It is worth noting that there is no indication whatsoever that Martha held any kind of prejudiced feelings toward her black neighbors. There were 12 free black families living in Hallowell during the years her diary was written. Martha delivered their babies and interacted with them as she did everyone else in town. She wrote their full names in her diary. So it is no stretch to believe that she simply did not know the name of this female doctor. I was personally fascinated with both the medical title and how Martha's neighbors would bypass her care and go to this other woman instead. Surely that means the woman had greater skill than Martha? Or that they had secrets to keep? Perhaps both. I changed the name Hannah Sewell to Grace Sewell in this book. There were just too many Hannahs in Martha's journal, a very popular biblical name at the time. And it became untenable to distinguish between them on the page. This Hannah, not that Hannah. Again, you're welcome. Because I know you're going to ask, no, I did not deliver any of my 4 children with a midwife. I wanted to. I believe in the work they do, and I trust the thousands of years' worth of knowledge that has been passed from one to another throughout human history. My mother had all 6 of her children at home with midwives. I was present for one of those births, and it quite literally changed my life. The sister whom I witnessed coming into this world later let me witness the birth of her son. It was a perfect full-circle moment. But my husband begged me not to. He certainly has nothing against this most noble profession either. He just couldn't stomach the idea of me being in such physical pain. And, dear listener, he was so earnest, tormented even, at the thought of seeing my body turned inside out without a scrap of pharmaceutical intervention. I love the man, so I conceded. And I do not regret it. Our youngest child might well have ended up stillborn otherwise. There are times when it is wise to put your medical care in the hands of a man who knows how to use a scalpel. Martha Ballard is the great-aunt of Clara Barton, founder of the American Red Cross. She is also the great-great-grandmother of Mary Hobart, one of the first female physicians in the United States. She left a medical legacy in this country that is unmatched, and it is all thanks to the diary she kept. Just words on paper, right? Seemingly meaningless? They're only the record of one woman's meticulous daily life. but those pages were preserved and passed to Dolly Ballard Lambert. She gave them to her daughter Sarah, who passed them on to Dr. Mary Hobart, who donated them to the Maine State Library, where they sat until they were organized and bound by Lucy Lambert Fessenden. Many years later, law librarian Edith L. Harry made those pages available to the public. And finally, Cynthia McCausland translated all 6 million bytes of text so that the full transcript could be published by Picton Press. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and professor, studied the diary and wrote the definitive biography of a woman who should have vanished from history, if not for one diary and the power of words. It bears repeating that this is a novel, a work of fiction, my version of what could have happened in this woman's life. It is not a biography, nor do I claim to be an historian. I'm simply a storyteller, and I have felt for 15 years that Martha's story is worth telling. I want you to know her name. I want you to tell your friends. I hope that you too are astonished by her life. I want the world to remember that small acts done in love matter every bit as much as the ones that make the newspaper and the history books. Toward the end of Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's biography, she has this to say. Martha Ballard ensured that she would not be forgotten. There was nothing in Christian tradition that said a midwife ought to keep a diary. For some complex of reasons, probably unknown even to her, Martha felt an intense need to recreate her own life day by day. She not only documented her prayers, her lost sleep, her deeds of charity and compassion, she savored and wrote down the petty struggles and small graces of ordinary life. The diary is a selective record shaped by her need to justify and understand her life, yet is also a remarkably honest one. It tells us that Martha was a devout Christian and humble nurse whose intelligence sometimes made it difficult for her to attend church or defer to her town's physicians. A loving mother, a gentle woman with a sense of duty and an anatomical curiosity that allowed her to observe autopsies as well as cry over the dead, a courageous woman who never quite learned to stay on her horse, a sharp-eyed and practical woman who kept faith in ultimate justice. Outside her own diary, Martha has no history. No independent record of her work survives. It is her husband's name, not hers, that appears in censuses, tax lists, and merchant accounts for her town. Nor does any extant record acknowledge the testimony she took from unwed mothers in delivery. Her name appears on a list of witnesses at the North rape trial, but no one except her preserved a record of what was said. Martha did not leave a farm, but a life, recorded patiently and consistently for 27 years. No gravestone bears her name, though perhaps there still grow clumps of chamomile or feverfew escaped from her garden. During the first week of May, 1812, Martha Ballard made her final diary entries. Tuesday, May 5. Snowed and very cold. I have felt very feeble. I have been at home. Wednesday, May 6. A very stormy day. I do not feel any better. I have been at home. Thursday, May 7. Clear most of the day and very cold and windy. Daughter Ballard and a number of her children here. Reverend Mr. Tappan came and conversed sweetly and made a prayer adapted to my case. I have been at home. Very feeble. The daughter Ballard, whom Martha refers to in this last entry, is none other than Sally Pierce, the young woman who remained a thorn in her side for most of this book. And while I have no doubt that her own daughters were at her bedside as well in her final days, I find this last mention of Sally incredibly sweet. I like to think they made amends. I like to think that the grandson made it possible. Martha died a few days after this last entry, leaving behind her husband Ephraim and all six of their living children. I love that the second-to-last phrase mentioned in her diary is the one she wrote most often, for it exemplifies the last 3 years of my own life as I have attempted to write her story. I have been at home. Me too, Martha. Me too.
This is Jane Oppenheimer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Frozen River, a novel by Ariel Lahon. This program was directed by Mary Diltz. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Edited by BookTrack. Text copyright, 2023, by Ariel Lahon. Production copyright, 2023, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.